First of all, I'm going to talk about the show, which is at the Artists Institute at the moment. It's an exhibition called Note to Self, and it's a collaborative exhibition with a painter from Glasgow called Alan Michael. Text and image, image and text. Paintings employing commercial techniques to trick and seduce, and stories formulaically constructed to captivate. The connection between method-based painting and genre fiction is crafted effect, whether that's dramatic tension or illusory depth, plausible enough to hook the consumer. Alan Michael and I have familiarized ourselves with the methodologies of illusionistic painting, trompe l'oeil and photorealism, respectively. And this is a painting of Alan's, and it's a painting, it's not a photograph, and there's no brush marks, it's really crazily perfect. Here's another of his paintings. We have stepped inside and out of these processes, repeatedly returning to gaze at the surfaces we have invoked on several occasions in direct comparison. This was a show in Dundee at the time where we both studied, where we met in the mid-90s. And in this instance, Alan hung his paintings in an installation of mine. And we liked the combination of these two different illusionistic surfaces and colour palettes. Our paintings are conventional, formal, and time-consuming, which are qualities that we use to reinforce our intentions with an emphatic weight that could not be achieved by merely presenting an object or photograph rather than its meticulously painted stand-in. Crime fiction structure can be studied and learned, then inhabited without rippling its populist surface. Seemingly innocuous material can be instrumentalized. The familiar escapism we associate with genre fiction can be the representative of procedures and standards that are routinely taken for granted. Why, for instance, does the market demand that the people on the cover of books be forced to have so little in common with the characters that they're meant to embody? And here we see Mr. Tom would play as a kind of hunky gladiator. And why is poison always considered a woman's weapon? A crime paperback as a piece of site-specific work. The location of the drama and the place in which it is read being the same. This is our book, Unlawful Assembly. And it's a collection of interrelated short stories that were intended as a cheap holiday read to titillate and entertain summer visitors to the Mediterranean island of Stromboli this summer. Our target audience were the participants and visitors to Volcano Extravaganza. And Volcano Extravaganza is an informal residency festival that's been going for the last few years. It's run by a collector who has a foundation called the Fiorucci Art Foundation, and I co-curated it this summer with the Foundation's director, Milovan. And our intention for Volcano Extravaganza was to produce an adequate object, a book of functioning narratives that could integrate into the scenery and props of civilized society at leisure. My story, Shooting Diary, is a self-contained tale of murder on the side of the volcano. The trio of short stories by Alan, The Nagging Flower, Magic Realism, and Not Going to Lie, are interwoven by a repetition of themes, phrases, and characters. Stromboli itself, and Stromboli is a volcano island, an active volcano island, so it's very kind of present. Stromboli itself appears alternately in distant reports or as a setting for events. Our narratives are intentionally confused by their specific sequence, and they have shared leitmotifs of narcissism, ineffectuality, and paranoia. and they both have watching and making films as subjects. Importantly, as a collaboration between two painters, the project was also anticipated as a means of generating source material and content for visual art in a way more complex than simply illustrating the texts. We both use appropriated imagery and ideas, often having an ambiguous relationship with our chosen subjects. We made some visual art from the book, and it's all treating the material like fake found material, and this is what we're showing at the Arts Institute at the moment. It's a problem that the book isn't commercially available yet, so how do you kind of do a show about a text if no one's read it, but hopefully the work can exist as this kind of generated material. And this is the show. So Alan's painting is called Gas is Rising. It's based on photography of vinyl exhibition signage, reusing the typography that was designed for us by HIT, a graphic design team from Berlin, for the original cover of the book. And he says, "The style of the painting alludes to the focal depth and reflection fetishes of classical photorealist painters. A potentially endless and shallow surface fabric, a space-filling analogue to the extremely conservative procedural formalism of crime fiction." And this is my painting. It's called Codley Bay 27, Unlawful Assembly, and it's a trompe l'oeil pinboard arrangement. Now, historically, these paintings, which have been around for the last few hundred years, were often used for the discreet expression of political and religious dissent. And this one can be likened to the research mind maps of the kind of detectives you get in DVD box sets, or sociopaths. It shows material relating to the writing of Shooting Diary, such as an email from one of my fictional protagonists to Alan, and there's a newspaper there, which is a real newspaper, it's Svezia, and it's a report about the massacre in Beslan. And one of my characters is the girl on the cover of the newspaper growing up. And also in there is the application form for the Crime Fiction Academy, which I'm currently a student at. And one of the objects is, and this is a painting I did at the same time for an art fair, using the same material, but the thing what really gets me excited about this painting is that it contains a photograph of my gallerist with an object which incriminates him for a really childish prank that I played on someone, and on a collector, a really horrible prank that could be read as extremely homophobic and very nasty. But I was in the mood, that was what writing the story does to you. And so I really like the idea of making a painting that my gallerist had to sell that incriminates him. I think selling art should be dangerous. So one of the other objects in the Quadley Bay is this book, The Mandibone Gate by Muriel Spark. And it's a Penguin edition from the 70s, and Muriel Spark's from Scotland. And she wrote about surveillance, blackmail, and betrayal within isolated groups such as nuns and expatriates. And she's most famous for the novel The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, that was made into a film and a play. Now, in the 70s, Penguin republished a back catalogue with a set of contemporary covers featuring specially commissioned photographs by somebody called Van Pariser, which I can't really find out anything about. They're in the then fashionable style of David Hamilton. I don't know if you know David Hamilton, he's the one that does the creepy pictures of little girls with the Vaseline on the lens. But these pictures are a bit like his girl children have grown up into vacant middle-aged women. And the soft focus effect implies romance, first and foremost, but also a kind of absent-mindedness. The complete opposite of the head screwed on, self-sufficiency and dispassionate sexuality that Spark attributes her heroines. They're all really tough, straight girls. What is she dreaming about? Like a great many mass market book jackets, this series gives the impression of being done on a low-paid, deadline-led production line, with only a cursory knowledge of the novel's setting and plot being necessary to aid the commercial artist in his or her work. And what's she dreaming about? And I've just started reading some Jean Rhys books, another extremely serious writer, but she also gets these kind of hazy girls on the cover. Nabokov famously demanded no girls for the cover of Lolita. And the deliberate misinterpretation on cover designs continues today. There was a fantastic article in the Huffington Post a few months ago, a project called Cover Flip by an author called Maury Johnson, where she asked graphic designers to imagine the covers of famous literature as if it'd been written by a woman, with all the, you know, women's literature always has stuff, women's faces and handwriting and butterflies, and it's great. Have a look on the Huffington Post. So Alan and I collaborated with an artist, Josephine Pride. She's a conceptual artist and a photographer who's shown at MoMA to produce a special portrait for the second edition of the book, which is coming out hopefully before the end of the year. And it will be commercially available. And what we wanted was a cover which tries to explicitly embody the disconnection between our characters and their visual representative. I mean, she's nowhere in the book, this girl. And we also wanted to insert our book within that Muriel Spark series, which we love, and just the world of the paperback in general. But we couldn't really, it was really hard to decide on the cover. We love them all. Our model is a girl called Marta, and we, Josephine and Alan, I all know her in a professional capacity, and we knew she was the woman for us. Italy is where Patricia Highsmith's anti-hero Tom Ripley learned the rudiments of impersonation and killing. And it's a photograph, both enigmatic and prosaic, taken by Spark in Florence in 1988, which serves as the blueprint for my series Stromboli. This is the photograph that Muriel Spark took. And here's my pictures. It's meant to be a contemporary update of Spark's middle-class literary milieu, but the setting and scene is corresponding. The anonymous figures are the readership of Unlawful Assembly. And this is just a few shots from the show. So, Muriel Spark and Patricia Highsmith were several of the writers that Alan and I discussed when we were on holiday in 2012 when we started to think about this project. And I've got a little memory of how it began. So Alan and I have similar tastes when it comes to books. We like precision, dreamy hysteria, and exploitation. Over time, the discussion and recommendation of books created a sublimated intimacy between us. He got me into 50 Shades of Grey, and knowing he was somewhere reading The Kindly Ones secretly connected us. On Stromboli, with a group of friends last summer, I got to sketch his portrait, another form of redirected affection. On the sunny terrace, he was reading accounts of secret Zionist cells in Palestine, and I was reading Rebecca West's The Meaning of Treason, political journalism arising from her reportage of court cases. One such case was that of Stephen Ward as part of the Profumo affair in 1963. I don't know if this is well known in America. They made a film in 1989 called Scandal, and Stephen Ward was played by John Hurt very well. Ward, here's another drawing of Alan. Ward used drawings to weasel his way into the lives of useful people, which made me reflect on my own motivations for drawing. It all seemed a bit like a good story. In Shooting Diary, oh, this is some of Stephen Ward's drawings. This is a portrait of Prince Philip, the Queen's husband. And this is a picture of one of the teenage prostitutes he would live with, including Christine Keeler. So in my story, the protagonists are attempting to make a pornographic art film. One of the group, a sociopathic thief of the Ripley mold, uses flattering portraiture as a tool for social climbing. My drawings of Alan were the precursors to his. There's a foreword to the book written by my gallerist, the one who's been set up for this horrible prank, Martin McGowan, and the filmmaker Ed Atkins. And the foreword roots the book in the specific context of the place it was meant to be read on Stromboli, but also links the book to the formal avant-garde, as typified by writers like Alain Robbe-Grillet, also another kind of Hamilton hazy shot. And the foreword gives us the quotation marks which the stories should be read. And it's not, I mean, we try as much as we can to write genre fiction, but it's, you know, we're artists, we're amateurs. But like fast food's ratio of fat, salt, and sugar to protein, our stories confront the subject of mundane chauvinism within the art world and everywhere in a similarly consumable package of calibrated sex, violence, and humor. Alan's stories are embedded within one another with dreamy circularity. They play with concealment and observation, and they're specifically filmic, and crime is inseparable from cinema and television. In the story, The Nagging Flower, we descend into the narrative of a graphic novel, while still within a film, showcasing a badly styled incarnation of a famous literary detective, as well as several different films in which the character has starred before, styled very badly. My characters in Shooting Diary express the same casually misogynistic opinions found in the novels of respected female crime writers such as Agatha Christie, P.D. James, and Ruth Rendell. And I don't know if you've read these British crime writers, but it's absolutely incredible how much these women hate other women. It's really strange, because they're so famous and respected. And I wanted my story to have the same kind of conservative tone. I didn't want to write as myself, I wanted to write like one of these people. And I used a lot of inane dialogue. I needed a lot of inane dialogue, and I got it from websites like Overheard in New York. I don't know if you ever look at this website, but it's great for chit chat, because I want the atmosphere to be conventional. And now in the story, this guy, this character is trying to make this kind of arty porn film. And I'm interested in the way so much work which intends to be kind of erotic just absolutely fails. And I've got some film stills from the films that Alain Robbe-Grillet made, and the books are so much better. It's really, really kind of heartbreaking to see how kind of clunky it is when the prose is so fantastic. So with my story, it's a crime story, but I wanted to explore what happens when people are trying to be sexy and they just can't because they're too stupid. So now I want to talk a little bit about this particular painting form, which is the quodlibet. So, quodlibet is the name applied to a trompe-l'oeil still life painting, which contains inorganic objects such as ribbons, letters, and playing cards, the kind of material found on a writing desk. It's really desky stuff. And they can be displayed vertically or horizontally, and historically they were unframed to maintain the illusion. And their main purpose is to trick and delight, and this gives them an ambiguous status between fine art and the decorative arts, which is very useful. and they were often painted to order for the client. Quarterly bays are also uncanny because they are painted using a one-to-one scale, and one-to-one is just experienced slightly different by the viewer. You feel it in a slightly more physical, bodily way, and there's a fantastic essay by Mike Kelly, of course, connected to his project, The Uncanny. And I think this kind of work can be grouped in that way of working. And the form of the Quarterly Bay is very flexible. It's one which a variety of ideas may be explored and refined. The paintings can act as abstract portraits by depicting objects connected to a specific person, place, or profession. They can tell stories by the placement of interrelated material in such a way as to create a visual narrative. And as I said, historically, by placing very specific objects next to each other, you could express a kind of very discrete descent. And because they're decorative, they're kind of entertaining and amusing, and lots of people like them because they look like proper painting. And in my work, I've managed to kind of work out a way to proceed, which means that I get to paint whatever I want. I get to paint all the stuff that really gets me going, like cats reading comic books. I mean, I've got the best job in the world. I get to draw cats reading comic books, especially as a woman. I mean, imagine if I'd been at art school in the 70s when everyone was into cybernetics and I wanted to paint kittens and bibs. You'd be mauled to death. And my enjoyment in being able to paint exactly what excites me is in the service of something more dispassionate and rational. So I get this kind of irrationality and rationalism together. And because I really enjoy painting or drawing what I do, I hope that kind of enthusiasm shows in the work and gives it a kind of vivacity and a passion. But my larger concern is that of examining structures and orthodoxies and how material, especially kind of innocuous or dead material, is instrumentalized by those in power, and especially how things like sexuality are just routinely exploited without question or challenged. And I want to talk about one piece in particular, which is Quarterly Bay, the most kind of minimal one I've ever done, and it's one of those angry email artworks, which I'm a huge fan of. And Muriel Spark's autobiography has some really great angry replies in it, and Ian Hamilton Finlay's written some fantastic angry emails to journalists. And this piece was in a larger installation, and what I needed this painting to do was to be a kind of counterpoint to some other work that was very academic and research-based. It was to do with architecture, and it was very historical. And I wanted there to be a second position in the show that was much more personal and in a way more kind of feminine, or in the mold of someone like, I don't know, some people like Tracy Emin or something, talk about something very private and personal. Not for itself, but just to have these two positions to balance them both and show you can have an exhibition that has both. And so this was an email, I'm going to read it to you. It was an email that I sent to our curator because I found out that an artist wanted to appropriate some images of me, because when I was a lot younger, I used to work for a photographer here in New York, Richard Kern, and I've also been a big fan of an artist called Cozy Fanny Tutti that in the 70s worked in the sex industry and posed for porn magazines and then used it in her work. And we, the three of us, even did a kind of symposium together, a talk at the ICA years ago, organised by Matthew Higgs. So here's the email. It's not fair to show you and you can't read it, so I'm reading it out. It's not a very great email, but you know. So dear blah 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 and blah blah blah, I got your email addresses from Cozy. The photographer, and I should say that these curators were curating a show about Cozy. It was called Cozy Complex, and it was the idea of using the word cozy as a noun. So, The photographer Richard Cairn recently wrote to tell me that an artist called blah 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 is seeking from him porn magazines containing photos of me taken by him to use in a work about me and Cozy for a show with you at the ICA. This artist has not contacted me, and Cozy, when I called her, knew nothing about it. I don't have an email for him, so approach you directly as the curators. Even though these photographs are in the public domain, and of course not my work, for which I could expect a notification of their use in an exhibition, I nevertheless feel entitled to have some say. His wish to appropriate the images is clearly informed by the fact I am a fellow artist. The connection between Cozy, Richard and myself is one that we made ourselves and not his discovery. If this goes ahead, these pornographic photos of my body and the indirect link to Cozy are being put to use by a male artist who bypasses the women involved to just transact with the pornographer, which is kind of mean to Richard. You know, it's not just the pornographer, but it sounded good in my argument. This would be an example of the inherent sexism and lip service to discourse that I position myself against. Please tell blah blah blah. Please let blah 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 know that if he uses my image or any reference to me, it is against my will. I do not wish to provide his content. And I'm someone who appropriates images all the time. And in principle, I don't care if somebody does something, you know, appropriating my work or whatever. It's all out there. But you've got to have the discourse. And I felt that this was a great opportunity as the subject of these, and especially when it's about your genitals. Someone wants to use pictures of your genitals, and I think you have the right to kind of say you want to talk about it. And you know, I've never really made any reference to that thing that I did, working with Richard in my work. It's never been like a theme or something. But I thought if there was ever going to be some reference to it, then this is a really good way to do it. It's so dispassionate, it's so cold, and it's so much better than pinning an email to the wall. Because when you paint it, people know you really fucking mean it. Because it took ages to paint. And so, in a way, it's a kind of self-portrait. Oh, there's one of Richard's pictures. I found this on the internet today when I had a look. So that was the kind of pictures we were doing. And I've shown you this because I recently became a professor of painting at the Kunst Academy in Dusseldorf. And a male student left this painting outside my door when I arrived. And then him and his friends put it on Flickr. And there was a big exchange in German about how it was going to be so great. I was going to be so angry. And it was going to be a scandal. And I just wish I'd bought it. Oh, and this is also White Columns selling a picture of one of Richard's pictures of me for their edition series. So I'm always kind of curious to see the way people kind of, you know, they're interested in the fact that I did this because I'm an artist. You know, I'm sure the fact that that White Columns had this picture of me is because of that. It's not any old girl. And of course, there's been times in the past when people have thought that they could kind of put me down or ridicule me for doing this, like I'd be embarrassed about it, and of course, I'm not embarrassed. So code levies can have controversial subjects. In the past, I've, for instance, made them about pornography and right-wing politics. But these are represented in a dematerialized way, with awareness and skepticism of modes of seduction, which painting can easily play into the hands of. By presenting taboo subjects as trompe-l'oeil pinboards or desktops full of reference material, there is the illusion of remaining research without the finality of becoming finished works. It's just a pinboard. I'm not a Nazi. This is my like reference inspiration. And without this conclusiveness, I can keep a degree of ambiguity, and I can have a space to work between these poles of the rational and the irrational, honoring both. And this is a scene, a view from a show I did in Antwerp last year called 50 Shades, And these three pin boards contain material all related to right wing interior design. So this was my research for a fascist bathroom. I don't know if you know, there's this book in the fascist bathroom, which I had as a teenager, and it always, this title always stuck in my head, because I thought, why did he call it that? It's just this one line in an essay about wire or something, and it's such a catchy title, In the Fascist Bathroom. What's the fascist bathroom like? So, and the thing is, it's very hard to find material on the domestic designs of totalitarian regimes. You always see those big over-the-top buildings, but you never just see a bathroom, a toilet. What does a fascist toilet look like? This is the only one I could find. Let me see, sort of point it. Yeah, here. This is the only illustration of a fascist bathroom I could find. And here was my designs for a fascist bathroom. In the end, they looked a bit more like Adolf Loos or something, but I don't know, maybe a little bit. I got a bit carried away. And these were really small. That was the box they were showing in, so it's a bit like a doll's house. And this was a Nazi living room. And you know, as much as this kind of dispassionate approach to these things, it is actually extremely depressing to go through all this material, read through these texts about Nazi interior design. But I don't know if you guys know this series of photographs by Lee Miller. She did this photo series where she had a bath in Hitler's bathtub. And I'm really not a fan of these photographs. It's just something about the idea of, it's such a staged photograph, you know, this picture of Hitler by the bathtub. It just gives me a bad feeling. I don't see it as some kind of gesture of freedom or something. I think it's very, very cynical. And this magazine is great, In Dekoration. These adverts on the back for all these German houseware products. And they all say things like, this will be available at the end of the war. And this was like research for a objectivist hallway. So objectivism is this kind of cod pop philosophy espoused by Ayn Rand, who I'm actually kind of a big fan of her writing. And I think actually part of the reason I wanted to do the show is that people give me such a hard time for liking Ayn Rand, because they think she's just so evil, and she's an idiot. But the books are really good, they're really good romances, and I do most of my reading through her books, and it's just great to listen to her books. They're so long, and they're great for the studio because you can just forward wind through all those speeches about how the strong are being suppressed by the weak, and just get back to these fantastic kind of Art Deco romances. So I imagined, you know, Tamara de Olympica for me is the kind of embodiment of, the visual embodiment of Ayn Rand's writing. Yeah, I get a hard time with my friends for even wanting to discuss things like Nazism. They always say to me, you're just trying to be shocking. I'm just sick of it, and I wanted to do a show. And my gallerist is Jewish, and she understood, she's very, very kind of knee-jerk about this kind of thing, but she understood that it's a way of exploring how you can talk about things that you just can't show them, because there's so much about seduction and shock. So this, for me, is a way to try and discuss things that I want to talk about in a way that I feel is morally acceptable to me. And this is a painting that was in the same show, and I wanted to do a painting about my favourite misogynists. So you've got Paul Verhoeven, and Ayn Rand, Robert Crumb, Alain Le Griez, and then Fogal is a kind of sublimated reference to Alan Jones because he did advertising for them. And there's a flyer for a friend's band, Country Teasers, who played around with kind of unpolitically correct material, very good results. And then the Kilgour adverts in the corner, that's Peter Saville. And I include him in it because I know him, and I know he's a sexist pig, even though he's so talented. And he's, you know, he's someone that, he sees women as kind of material, they kind of represent something. He's only interested in women to represent sex and glamour. And I like these because they show this God is him, is his body. And then I did another one, and it's pretty confused, this one, but this was meant to be my painting of all the misogynists that I don't like. So you've got Vanessa Beecroft, and Mel Ramos as the kind of counterpoint to Alan Jones. Again, this idea, like, what, how come, you know, Baltus is great, but Mel Ramos isn't? It's about something about intelligence and talent, and it's hard to define, but so I've got in there like Lars von Trier, because I really don't like the way his female actresses get completely brutalized in all the films, and then they always win the Pandora, as if that's what you've got to do to get a trophy. And yeah, 50 Shades of Grey is in there. I don't know why I put that in there, because I actually love 50 Shades of Grey. And it's another really good, long, boring book for the studio. It's so consistent. And I love the fact that it's written by this middle-aged English woman trying to imagine what a millionaire and a student get up to. You know, what shows he's really rich is that he drinks Twinings tea. And she's like 19 and she's never looked at porn online and she doesn't have an email address. It's, like, that's my ambition as a writer, to be able to write something like that, like, to be like this person trying to write something, they've got no idea what they're talking about. That's what I would like to do. And then there's the collaboration between Richard Prince and Louis Vuitton, just like past the sick bag. And I included William Burroughs and Gus Van Sant, just as, I mean, William Burroughs is great, but there are two people that just could not care less about women, and I don't like the way women are portrayed in Gus Van Sant's film. And also I'll put Ballard in there. He's also, I mean, he's a great writer, but the same, like, women are just there as, like, they're all the same character every time. They're just these kind of sex objects, and there's always this formula in his books with a certain kind of middle-class protagonist and a sexy girl. And yeah, I don't know. I don't think this painting is very successful, but it was really fun to make, and it really kind of gave me a lot of pleasure to kind of think about who I could include. Vanessa Beecroft again. Women are just kind of decor. Women in bikinis are just like in the background at the Guggenheim. It's fine. And the last thing I want to talk about, which isn't so organized, is, I guess it continues with my interest in literature. I think I want to talk a little bit about a project that I'm about to work on for the Arts Institute, which is some little scenes of a play, which are going to be turned into a film, and I'm going to work with my old friend Richard Cairn on. And so this was in the same show as the fascist and sexist pig paintings. So the book is The Girl Who Followed Marple. And the story of The Girl Who Followed Marple is about a young girl comes to Ostend, where Miss Marple is recuperating from some one problem like she often has. And this girl has come to Ostend because she wants to be Miss Marple's protege, and she wants to help her with her fact-finding and problem-solving. But in the course of her kind of stalking Miss Marple, she realizes that Miss Marple is a much more sinister character than she first thought. And there's a Mr. Marple. So she's Miss Marple, not Miss Marple. And this was painted on paper with oil, and then it was wrapped around a copy of 50 Shades of Grey, which at the time was really, really popular. And I guess I'm interested in the way that there's just so many extremely successful women who write this kind of genre fiction or populist fiction. There's plenty, of course, also in literature, but people like Agatha Christie to J.K. Rowling, this book. And there's something about the whole idea of genre, which I just wonder if maybe historically some women have been drawn to, because it means then that the work isn't considered as literature and it wouldn't be compared to their male counterparts. It's kind of, there's a safety within genre. And you've got Daphne du Maurier and all the great British female crime writers. There's just so many extremely successful women writers of kind of airport literature or school syllabus literature, the Brontes, 50 Shades. I mean, it's interesting for not what it thinks it is, but I've read all three and they're just, you just get in the zone and they're really enjoyable. I'm a huge fan of also amateur writing. I mean, everybody has the urge to write. Only a tiny fraction of what's written is published, and I'm an amateur writer. And the book came out of an exhibition that was in Ostend in 2012 called Te Kust en Te Kua, and it was a group show with this group of women here. Not a smile among us, but we were really pissed off with the photographer, because he wanted to put us in a cherry picker against this guy, like little Easter chicks in a basket. And then when we pointed that out, he was really angry. And that's the weird thing, when you point out these kind of casual little sexist gestures, you still feel bad about it. You still feel bad for being like meddlesome, which is a funny thing to deal with. You know, maybe we're just brought up to please, and that's why we feel bad about it. But I felt really bad about bawling out as photographer. And this was the show. It was existed only in the windows of the museum. The place is called Musée in Ostend, and it shows the collection of Flanders in Belgium. I'm not going to go into the details of the Belgian divide with language and all this. It's in Flanders. And Ostend is this kind of historic town. It's where James Ensor was from. And it's a bit like Coney Island or something. It's got this seaside faded grandeur. It's a really, really beautiful, evocative place. And this museum used to be a supermarket. So our idea with the show was to do a show that looked like the windows of the most delirious department store you've ever seen. And it was meant to be seen at night. Everything was really big. And you only saw it from behind when you were in the museum. And everyone that I invited to participate, there were artists or designers, and they were all people I'd worked with closely before, and they all made work that was, the things that they did could be art, it could be design, it could be a display device, it could be advertising for itself or something else. It was really, again, I use the word flexible, but it could be this thing that wasn't just stuck as being having to be in a gallery. It could be this different stuff, and we could collaborate and make things that you just didn't know what it was, if it was fashion or design or appropriation. And it was interesting to do a show that was kind of about, it's not about shopping, because with everyone involved, we were also in a group show that I organised in Zurich the year before, and the show got completely panned by lots of different writers who all construed it in that if you're making work which is related to craft and virtuosity and quality and skill, that's equated with luxury, and that's not the case. That's not what William Morris thought. It's not fair that just because something's well made, it means it's got to be kind of elitist. And the subject of shopping or the artist's relationship with products, with consumption, production and consumption, I find very interesting. I think that the stuff that pop art appropriated is much, much more interesting than pop art. And so when we were there, we were hanging out in Stalin, having a terrible time trying to do this huge show. We just started kind of thinking about stories and narratives, and I came up with this idea of the girl that followed Marco, inspired by my relationship to the women in the show and to products. And so these little films I want to make will be, in a way, like promo films for the fashion label that I do with my partner, Becca Lipscomb, and also certain products that I really recommend, like this one. This is the Moon Cup. I don't know if you know it, but it's this reusable thing for your period. And it's like the Kalashnikov or something. It's just perfect design that cannot be beaten. You buy one when you're 13 and a half, and you use it till you're 55, and you wash it, and it's perfect design. It's just the packaging is really crap. And so I thought of, like, I'd like to redo the packaging. So this is my new Moon Cup poster. And I was thinking about the way in the 60s that advertising, capitalism or whatever, used feminism and used counterculture to sell products to that target audience. So she's a kind of groovy pop art, yellow submarine girl with her beautiful yellow brick road period blood. And when you use the Moon Cup, you see that period blood is, if you're maybe this is the painter's eye, but it's so beautiful. The colors, it's really like really beautiful stuff. And there was a history, like in Selfridges in the 19th century, they used to put on little plays in the department store, and the actresses would wear clothes that you could buy in the shop. So I want my little Miss Marple play to be set in, it's going to be filmed in a department store, one scene's in a department store, the other's in a hotel. And it should feel a bit like kind of product placement for either imaginary products or my fashion line, my real products. I love this story about in the Soviet Union, the biggest like style, the biggest style thing to pull off was if you could go out in an outfit where everything was the same color. You had a blue hat and a blue jacket and a blue bag, because that showed you had enough clothes to go out, and you didn't just have a brown coat and a black dress and green shoes. And just thinking about, you know, what would happen about consumerism if it's not something that you just grow up with as a kind of mother tongue. It's something you have to learn. And imagining people engaging in these kind of private acts of consumption, making adverts for things that they can't buy, that don't exist. And this is what I wanted the show to have a feel of. This is Miss Margaret. And so the actress that plays her will have to have a lot of old lady makeup, which then maybe she'll slowly reveal over the, like, move over the course of the story. Maybe she'll even have a period. And of course, the template is the Highsmith book, The Boy Who Followed Ripley, where Ripley has a young protege come over from America and seek him out, and they end up in gay bars in Berlin and drag. It's a really amazing book. And this is a work that I'm lucky enough to be able to show at the Artist Institute. It's a work from 2003 by the Czech artist Milena Dopitova, called 60-something, and her and her sister are dressed up in old lady makeup and they're kind of dancing about, and I really love it. And this is the last image. It's my proposal for the book jacket of the Arabic version of The Prime of Miss G. Brodie. So thank you.